The fool may think he's a wise man, but the wise man knows what a fool he's been. I'm Paul Falcone. Welcome to the Pro Fools Podcast.
I'm Paul. I'm here with Mark Mandelbaum. We are at ABC Times Square Studios. We just finished up Good Morning America. Let's get right into it. Mark, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
I'm really glad to have you. What drew you to audio? And what drew you to, I know you have a music background, what drew you to audio and what drew you to music?
Well, before we get to that, I want to point out the very like U.S. Senate style love that I've created here for myself.
I have to say that is really cool.
So this way I have my hands free. I just wanted to point that out, that it's intentional, that it's not an accident. So what drew me to audio, it's very simple. I know the day that I became interested in music, which is February 9th, 1964, my brother's fifth birthday, my entire family, aunts, cousins gathered together. But at 7 o'clock, everything grinds to a halt because the Ed Sullivan Show is coming on, which used to be an absolute national event every Sunday. And we all went down to the rec room and we're sitting around the TV and the Beatles come on. It's their first appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show. And I watched, my jaw dropped. I was just shy of seven, and I turned to my folks and said, my birthday's coming up soon, I want a guitar. That was really what drew me in. Getting onto the audio side was when I was in college as a guitar player, and I'd played in bands all through high school and was playing in a band in college, but an RA across the hall was in a recording program that I didn't even know Fredonia State College, SUNY Fredonia, had. Heard me playing in my room. He said, I'm doing a session. I need a guitar player. Could you come in? I did that. Pretty soon I was, for 11 minutes, I was the hot guitar player in the program. Except I noticed, I felt like they were having more fun than I was in the control room. And I decided after a semester that I was going to apply to get into the program, which took me a while to do because they didn't love electric guitar players. And I went into the Tone Meister program at SUNY Fredonia and learned a lot of wonderful basic stuff from a lot of very talented people, both teachers and students. It's a combination music and technology program, and that's how I got to the recording side of it, the audio side of things, which have led not just to recording music, but also led me to broadcast.
That is fascinating to me that you discovered the studio in college as a guitarist?
As a guitar player.
Yeah.
We had done informal recording in high school. I had a friend who had a two-track that you could bounce back and forth, and he and I, especially he, but I would occasionally add the guitar or vocal part. We would do covers. One particular one I remember was, believe it or not, Paul McCartney's Listen to What the Man Said. But we always had different bands going on, and Beatle harmonies were always part of it, but also Carlos Santana songs were always big then, and all sorts of different kinds of music. But when I got to college, I just fell in love with the recording process and the creativity of the interaction between the players, the engineers, the producers, the way to manipulate the technology. I remember, discovering that if we put a speaker at the bottom of a stairwell and mic'd up the stairwell, that we could get custom reverb, natural reverb. And I just, that was amazing to me. That, like, forget dialing up a wonderful spring reverb on my little Fender amp. This was like, really natural reverb. So yeah, the whole process fascinated me, and that's how I swung around from the player side, which I still do, to the audio side, which has become a career.
That's fascinating to me that you discovered it through school, and certainly that you discovered being able to manipulate sound like that, and that even Fredonia had a program at that time.
It was one of the first. The control room was designed by John Stork. It was just attached to a giant band rehearsal space, so it was basically like recording in a gymnasium, so we had to get good at building little huts to enclose things that we wanted to close up the sound a little bit. Singers, drums, usually. And they also ruined the Stork design control room by not putting in the speakers that he designed the acoustics and the soffits for, but instead somebody else somebody in the college thing decided, oh no, we'd rather have these speakers. And there were real audio problems because of it, which we were all aware of, because we knew the anomalies. And Stork was very generous with us, but he also told us, look, there's nothing I can do. I designed it for this pair of speakers. I designed it with this interaction between the speakers in the room, and they made a choice that I can't do anything about.
I didn't realize that John was into working on facilities for, you know, schools at that point. That had to be not long after he did Electric Lady. That's pretty, I would say, early on in his career.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, we're talking about a program that got up and running sometime in the mid-70s. When I joined the program, I want to say it was It was autumn of 77, and the facility had already been in place for a while. It was a 16-track MCI machine, a 24-channel MCI 400 series desk. We had a BX20 spring reverb. We had a few different two tracks so we could set up tape slaps. Like I said, we improvised reverb spaces. I think there was one very early digital delay. Believe it or not, there was a Fairchild compressor. Mm. There was a huge pile of Neumann mics, as well as some wonderful Electro Voice mics. This thing keeps slipping down, but I apologize. So the technology that they gave us to work with was really great. And the freedom they gave us to work in the studio was really great. The program became a little more structured later. Back then, it was really like, they give you a key, you let yourself in, they get, you know, don't break anything, you lock up when you leave. More likely, as you're leaving, the next guy or woman, there's only a couple of women at the time, is coming in. The studio was in play every minute that there was not an actual band rehearsal going on, and sometimes even then there'd be people working in the control room trying not to disturb the band rehearsal. But the studio was a 24/7, 365 thing. A lot of us didn't go home for vacations. You know, we wanted to make use of every bit of it. Believe it or not, the first couple of 10,000 Maniacs records were done there. A guy named John Petrie did a lot of early records there, a group called The Rods. I did some local acts there. Talis, I'm pretty sure Billy Sheehan and Talis were in there at least a couple of times. I did a band from Toronto called Klo, K-L-O. And we did like an entire album's recording in 42 straight hours. I took one shower and I fell asleep at the desk at least once. I had rotating A2s so that somebody at least would be sane while we did all this. And then we mixed the whole thing a couple of weeks later in like 1 6-hour session. It was about 10 songs. One of my guys recently found cassettes and he sent me some files of it. It sounds great. It really held up. I was real pleased about that.
So much to take in there. First of all, really being able to immerse yourself into the technology and have such access to it, giving you the ability to experiment and really learn the craft by experimentation at college is such an interesting thing. Also talking about the technology that you learned on the 16-track and the Fairchild and, you know, Spring Reverb. So I know throughout your career, you certainly watched a technological shift, and I know you've been, you know, definitely jumped on newer technology. We've talked about computers and, you know, early sequencers and even, you know, where the sequencers, you know, got to. I mean, you got to see a major shift in technology throughout the early part of your career.
Well, throughout. I mean, there's no question. From analog multitrack to synced analog multitracks to the first ADAT synced to analog multitrack so that you could get a hybrid there, and then the early recording workstations. And the Pro Tools had a precursor, actually, before it was called Pro Tools, that a lot of people worked on. And then, of course, that just where we are now, really, Pro Tools and all its brethren.
Yeah. So how do you think the role of the engineer changed through that? Or has it?
No, it definitely has. I mean, up till the very last things that I did, because I had the background that I had, especially recording live acoustic instruments, because I had a background in recording ensembles, because I went to a music school so I could read scores, not well, but I could read scores, I got a lot of great opportunities to record basics with some amazingly talented musicians. I also had an opportunity through a particular arranger writer, singer, guitar player, pianist to record orchestral parts and horn sections and things that I didn't get that many opportunities to record. But right up till the end, I was doing things. For me personally, my strength was always, even till the end, was not so much digitally manipulating, but getting acoustic instruments well recorded to tape so that other people could manipulate it if they wanted, could mix it without me or bring me into mix, could use that as a basis. And I worked plenty with keyboard player synthesis, and I worked on a lot of hip hop, so I was very lucky. I was worked on some seminal hip hop, but my strength even there was like, oh, do you want to add live drums? Oh yeah, I can do that. I'm qualified to do that. And that went right up till the end. The role of the engineer has changed so much because now guys they're editing so much. Before edits, there could be a lot of edits in a piece, but it was 2-inch editing or 1/2-inch editing, building a remix, let's say, piece by piece on a 2-track machine. But, you know, so much of it was about being able to punch accurately, which was a bit more of an art form when it was destructive. Being able to interface with the musician in that way and really, you know, feel what they were looking to do. And I think it's a more solitary thing now. So many people, great musicians, have setups of their own. Except for the really rich guys who can afford to have an engineer who comes into their home studio. But a lot of other people just have the ability to create on their own, which is very democratic. I mean, I did a Panic at the Disco track for a anniversary package of the soundtrack for Nightmare Before Christmas. And it was all these different artists doing it. And Panic at the Disco hired this engineer, super talented arranger, a guy named Rob Mathis, who's worked with everybody, to do a 30-plus piece orchestra. And we did that, of course, in Pro Tools, that recording. But Panic brought their parts in, having done it in hotel rooms on tour, in GarageBand. How much more democratic could you be? And their parts sounded great. Nobody, you know, once we transferred, nobody ever listened to that CD release and says, well, the orchestra sounds great, but what a shame that Panic's vocals and guitars and all the rest, what a shame that their stuff doesn't sound as good. It sounds great. It's so democratic, and that's great. We're not gatekeepers anymore. And what I found was anybody with a laptop started calling themselves an engineer and or a producer. And in the beginning, I made a point of not playing or singing on records because I didn't want to take work from those people. But once it became like every guy says, I can engineer a record, so it was like, okay, well, I can play guitar parts on your records. I can play anything. I can play almost any instrument that you don't have to blow into on your records and add backup vocal parts. So now I'm free to do that too. I have the setup. So that part of it changed dramatically also. Everything becomes a one-stop shop, more or less, especially if you're not doing live drums. So I became freer to be more creative in that level, and not just creative by helping them get their vision onto tape, but also contributing. Oh, I hear a 12-string guitar part. Cool, let's do that. I hear backup vocals. Let's do that. So in that sense, it changed dramatically. Earlier on, we were much more about having them play. And then it became like, everybody's a player, everybody's an engineer, everybody's a producer, everybody's a writer. You know, so that in that sense, it changed dramatically.
I love that you were able to take the fact that the technology was being put into sort of everyone's hands, and instead of it just broadening the role for other people, it broadened your role as well. That you're talking about able to contribute now more musically, that you weren't just taking on the role as the engineer. I do think that is the modern approach where, you know, everyone has the ability to engineer the recording to a certain degree, but then there are the professionals that they go to take those recordings to the next level, or sometimes just to be able to work on those projects further.
Did a few projects like it, but one particular one, a guy and his buddies, the guy wants to do a record, he brings together all his buddies who are musicians, he has a grandparent who has a getaway home in Brattleboro, Vermont. And it's a big home with a giant communal table and in the kitchen and a lot of bedrooms. And he invites all his buddies up, not just the players, but friends. And then he brings me up. I bring my wife up at the time of practicing architect. She spends the day doing drawings. We're making the record with just a laptop and an 8-channel interface. Because the granddad was on the board of the Met, Metropolitan Opera, there were two grand pianos facing each other. So we got to play around with not only piano parts, but also even just taping down strings and creating odd ambiences in key. So I helped them build these basics, and then we had all these wonderful communal meals. We'd go to sleep. They'd stay up all night, like playing hootenanny, basically. And then I heard what he did with the manipulations afterward, and it was just so creative. It didn't matter that he wasn't a trained engineer. He was willing to experiment, and he had the freedom to experiment because it was his time, it wasn't money. And he did a great job. He made a beautiful record. He did not bring me in again for any of it, and it worked out great. I mean, I had the fun of recording basics and meeting a whole lot of talented young people, but that became a model for how projects happened, as I went out and helped people record in their basements, in their parents' basements, in their parents' living rooms. And then I would watch them get creative with it, and sometimes I'd come back for the mixing, sometimes for comping the vocals that they cut. And so it could be all these different levels, but the creativity unleashed was just amazing to me. And even when I went back to do some teaching at my school, I finished my degree. I left school early, 11 credits short. 23 years later, I finished my degree. And part of it was going back to teach. And these students had such creative projects that I got to hear. And that was so exciting to me also. They were so clever and so advanced and so fearless and so creative about using the tools that they were native to. I was an immigrant. They were native to these tools. So I've also really enjoyed watching the way the industry has changed, even as, of course, there are big problems there, the fact that it's more and more difficult to make a living. Like our society, the whole middle class has been hollowed out. I was a middle class engineer. I had a lot of great record credits, but it's like kids fresh out of school who are willing to work for nothing on a laptop, or the super rich making Pitbull records, you know, with 19 producers and 13 writers and nothing. And the middle got hollowed out. And the same thing in record sales, so that middle-class bands are having to make their living on merchandise and touring rather than being able to sell a decent number of records. Though, if they're releasing the records on their own, at least they can keep everything that the record generates, which is great. Anyway, so I don't even remember where that started. That's a lot of information.
That's great, Ian, because you're describing certainly a shift in not only just the recording industry, but the music industry and entertainment industry itself. What I love about a lot of that story is describing the experimentation that eventually was done with technology that was accessible to everyone. And when you describe your time at Fredonia, that you were also very much into experimentation there. I love that common thread of continuing to experiment.
Absolutely. And one thing, as the business changed, my rate never changed over the 20 plus years I was really in the recording business. But studio rates, the pressure was ever down. And because budgets became smaller, one thing that I did regret when we were still studio based as opposed to home studio based is some of the experimentation got lost because we didn't have as much time to let people freely try an idea. They had to finish a mix. They had to get two mixes a day. We couldn't try something wild on a mix. They had to get all the drum basics for an album in 2 days of recording. So the drummer was under a lot of pressure, and I had a lot less freedom to experiment with different micings. And so some of that was I had more of it in the very beginning and more of it later. And in the middle, some of it was more about just the utilitarian, you got to dive in and do this. But it also made me more creative about setting up in a way that if I wanted to try something quick, I could. I've got things routed out to a guitar amp that's set to a vibrato just to see, is that going to add something to it? I've got delays and ambiences going all the time so that I can try them during the rough mixes. There's one particular record I did where we finished the recording. I had what I thought was a great rough mix, and I said to the artist, because I knew mixing was going to be very low budget, I said, you give me 15 minutes and I've got the mix right here. And sure enough, that mix made it to the album. It was not as polished as it might have been if I'd spent a half day working on it, but it had all of the right elements right there, really present. And we both felt it in the studio. And I was lucky enough that I made the case. I was lucky enough that he was receptive and not worried, like, ooh, it's not a formal mix. It was a great rough. And I can listen to the record to this day and say, well, that mix holds up beautifully. So some of the experimentation was lost. We had to be a little bit more creative about how to get the experimentation in there. Again, now the things are people's home studios. You know, there's the ability for young people, especially, of course, to again, go nuts with experimentation. And, of course, the super rich, the pit bulls, can do whatever the hell they want because the budgets are still gigantic, insane.
I think you make a really important point in that even through experimentation, it is important to take a direction when you're recording. So you are working towards a final mix. So you are getting it to the point where it's not like when you get to the mix stage, you're starting from scratch and you have to create all these sounds, that you are working on the project with the direction and the fact that you can mix it in 15 minutes and have it sound like a finished record.
Well, yeah, I mean, it happens that generally I didn't think I was great at that. I was not one of those guys who every time he pushed up the mix, he'd be building his final mix and saving every mix to the SSL memory so that I could come back in right at that moment. Because I like the spontaneity of coming to it fresh, almost like I'm a mixer coming new to the project. I love that spontaneity. That particular one, because he was under so much financial pressure, because we ended up mixing the entire record again, like 15 tracks in the course of 2 days, I knew we were going to be under a lot of pressure, and I knew I had that mix. I knew if he'd give me just a few minutes, I could tighten up the couple things I need to tighten up, print it, and then that's one that we don't have to worry about later on. But in general, I have to admit, I kind of liked coming fresh to a mix, not being wedded to the reverb we'd been using all along, not being wedded less necessarily to the vocal effects we'd been using all along, not being wedded to the relationships even between the drums within the kit, between the drums and the rest of the rhythm section, between the rhythm section and the featured instruments. But because budgets got tighter, there's no question, the creativity became about how to make things happen under budgetary pressure. That in the beginning, I got to be honest, I got very lucky when I came out of school. We didn't have that. I got involved with some very good, well-funded projects, and we had a lot of flexibility to play around.
This leads me to my next question. We were talking about spontaneity and high pressure. How did you make the switch to television, and specifically live television?
Okay, so I had a specific skill set. I had toured as a monitor mixer. I had toured as a front-of-house mixer. I had toured as a combination road manager, front of house mixer. I was never a big road guy, but mostly with artists that I had some relationship with already, occasionally brought in as a problem solver. But I had enough background in live that I could do all those things. And in 2003, 9/11 had happened, things were, technology was changing, everything was changing. And I was on the phone with a very dear friend of mine, a woman who was the executive producer of all things, a cooking show that featured a full live band every episode. Sometimes guest band, sometimes a house band. But they needed someone who could work the production side, tracking the chef's mic, other guests as they talk, but also could, that front of house position was the production mics, the music front of house mix, and the monitor mix, all from one desk, including wedges and ears. And they needed somebody. So I was on the phone with this very dear friend who was the EP of this show. And we were both sort of bemoaning. I was complaining about the way the music business was changing. She was bemoaning that she had just lost an A1. That's the guy who mixes the show. the production mix. Her front of house guy wanted to move out to that slot, and he bailed out on her with a week before their next run. And I said, well, what's involved? Because I didn't know at the time. She said, well, I need someone who can do this, this, this. I said, well, it sounds like those are the things I do. Why don't I give it a shot? And she was open to that. To her credit, she told the rest of the audio crew, especially that A1 front of house guy, that they would make the decision whether I was up to it. She'd get me in the door, but she wasn't going to keep me in if they were unhappy with what I was bringing to the table. They, on the other hand, let's face it, the A1 had a big incentive to make it work out for me so that he could move up to stay in the A1 slot. So those people, I learned so much. They were so generous with their knowledge. I was so green. But it worked out great. The show was Emerald Live. I got to work not only with his house band, but with all these great guest bands. And that I did that for five or so years, a lot of seasons tucked into those 5 or so years. And that just led to other opportunities. The A1 liked what I brought to the table. He invited me to be part of other projects. I met other A1s at the building. I started doing A1 for some of their other projects. I started doing the production music mix to air, as opposed to being the guy doing the front of house, all that stuff. I started doing occasionally just the guy who mixed the band for what the audience heard at home, which is different than the front of house mix. And then when that ended, just coincidentally, when I had done some work for All Mobile doing some remotes, I was lucky enough to do the Indy 500 one year, and they hired me from time to time to do some pretty great things. But I was really lucky. ABC was looking for people for their audio for their New York news division. They specifically posted they needed a job, somebody with a strong music background. I thought, well, that's me. I was pretty arrogant. They hired me, immediately put me onto the production side, and never really used my skills as on the music side, which was very lucky for me, of course, because it forced me to learn all these great new skills in comms, which is the communications, all that stuff. The actual on-set work as an A2, miking someone, troubleshooting, setting up the IFBs, which are the little listening squigglies. I learned all these great things in addition to learning to take my mixing skills and translate them to TV and all the things that that requires. And also, when I got there, found out that from a music side, I had good credits and I thought I was great. But there were guys who had mixed Allman Brothers. There were guys who had mixed Queen records. There were guys who had done Madonna records. There are guys who had done really an amazingly great array of acts who were on the music side. And so while I was sure that if I had the opportunity, I could have competed there, I was really very lucky that they put me on the production side. And, you know, that led directly to my ability to do comms for the shows now at ABC and other places that I do, and to mix the places that I do, including some shows at ABC. But it was really a phone call. If I had had that phone call with her 2 weeks later, she might have already found someone. If I had it with her 2 weeks before, she might not have needed me yet. So she might not have thought to mention it. I stepped in it. And it was an amazingly great thing for me. And she would say for her, because I brought stability to that position. The A1 was incredibly stable in his position for the 5+ years that he and I worked together. The audio side of that show was incredibly, incredibly stable. And the EP once, she was great about making sure that he had the funds to create what he needed for audio on the show. But what she loved was that it became something that she never had to worry about. All she had to do was meet the need, technological needs, but she never worried like, what am I going to do? Is this going to work? Because she trusted that the A1, a great talented guy named Steve Watson, she trusted me. The other crew members who've continued, you know, gone on to do other great things since they left there. But it was, you know, it became easy for her. And that's the most important thing when you're running an entire operation, that any department is something that you don't have to worry about. So it worked out great for both of us.
I love so much of that story. I would say that, you know, they say chance favors the prepared mind. Like it's not really luck that you landed into that situation. You put yourself in the right place at the right time and had the skill set to take advantage of that opportunity.
Well, that's the big thing is that the break was lucky, but that I was open to learning. The fact that temperamentally I fit into the crew. The fact that this was just the right A1 to learn under. I've worked with A1 since, who are very talented guys, but weren't the teachers that he was. They weren't the collaborators that he was. This guy was just so open and such an inspiration to me. And I try to do that to this day when I have the opportunity to teach the guys, to bring people into a position to upgrade their skills, to learn new positions, music playback or co-mixing, what they call the A1B position at ABC. I'm hearing his voice in my head every time saying, yeah, be generous. Be the guy who's teaching people the right way, who's protecting their crew, who is making sure that the crew has the tools that they need to do it. I'm hearing his voice, Steve Watson. Amazing, amazing, amazing A1. And a big-time music guy in his own right. I mean, he had some great credits before he began focusing on broadcast, where he has an incredibly solid career. And he continues to do a bit of music. He does a bit more still than I do. You know, I'm just lucky that he was the guy.
Yeah. I love that approach. An expression that I've heard is, when we all move forward together, success takes care of itself.
There you go. Excellent.
So from what I've observed in your approach to work, and something that I never knew about live television, is just how much it's based on feel. And it feels very musical, especially watching you work. Like it feels like you have a very musical approach to television. Can you speak on that?
Well, I don't honestly think of it that way. I'm very sensitive to the blend I'm trying to create, but I'm also a very, I like to give people their responsibilities, trust that they're going to do their job to the best of their ability. And so I can be pretty hands-off when it comes to either the way my floor people work with talent, provide the tools that I need to make sure I have good audio. I try not to micromanage any of the interactions that I have, whether it's with comms, whether it's with music playback. And I just try to roll with what I'm being given. But I don't really, I never really thought of it that way. I mean, if you see it that way, that's great. What I will say is that because of my music background, I'm processing music even almost all the time when I'm not directly otherwise involved with what's in front of me. There's either music being created in my head, or I'm spooling music, you know, known music in my head. So a lot of my life does feel very musical to me, but I never thought of it in terms of it translating to how I approached mixing the show. I think that's interesting. I'm going to give that some thought.
Yeah. I really like that you touched upon the team, you know, you being the A1, and there is a team of audio people around here, and you know, like you mentioned, the comms people, and I certainly never realized how many people work on a live television show. As an A1, what do you feel are some of your, what's the most important part of your job? I mean, I know obviously it's getting a great mix, you know, for broadcast, but I mean, separately from that.
I came to a realization many years ago that there's three things that I need to get satisfaction. I need the tools to create excellence in whatever I'm doing, whether I'm working at the Park Slope Food Co-op stacking boxes, or whether I'm mixing a record or mixing a TV show. I need the tools to create excellence. I need the expectation from those who have brought me into the project that I am going to provide excellence, expect excellence from me, and then get out of the way of that pursuit. Don't set up roadblocks. So the way I approach the crew is I want to make sure every one of the people that we work with, and it's a little different here than some other places. I've worked on TV shows where the A1 truly is the head of the crew. Here we're all really more a gang of equals. But still, if there's a problem with audio, production looks to me. So I want to make sure that all of us have the tools to do what we need to do the job to the best of our ability, to create excellence. And then I want to let them know that I have faith in their ability to provide excellence. And then I want to make sure that I don't micromanage them so that I get in the way of them making excellence. When I need things, I ask for it. When I see a problem, I try to address it rather than just grouse about it. I try to talk to people and help them to understand where they may not be providing the best that they could be providing. And here's what they could do that would give me what I need to then continue to strive for what I'm striving for. So that's what I'm trying to get those three things from. I'm trying to give those three things to everybody around me. Now, those three things are I'm being real serious. I could be stacking boxes at the Park Slope Food Co-op, and I feel a very similar level of satisfaction when I've done the job right than when I've created a great live TV mix or a great record mix. I feel satisfied. I always want to feel like I've done the best that I can and given whoever I'm providing it for as close to the best as they can get. I'm striving for excellence even if I don't always achieve it. And in whatever thing I'm trying to do, I'm trying to reach that level of excellence.
I think that's a fantastic approach. I mean, first of all, teamwork makes the dream work. But not only that, being satisfied with doing the best job we can do with and giving the people around you the right tools and getting the right tools for yourself in order to get the best product that you can make. I think it's a solid approach.
There you go.
Yeah. Wow, that's awesome. You just gave so much information and so much background. I really appreciate all that. We're getting ready to wrap it up. I got to ask you one question. It's sort of a signature question that we've been asking since the early days of this podcast. People have answered it in all sorts of different ways. What's the best mistake you've ever learned from? And I'll say that, like, I know for myself, I made a lot of errors early on in my career. And even now, I don't mind, you know, if I can learn from a mistake. First of all, I can learn from the things I do right, and I can learn from the things I do wrong. I had someone on the podcast recently that said everything that they know they learned by making mistakes to get to the point where they are. But can you think of one, either from your early career or at some point?
Well, the reason we learn so much from mistakes is because they drill down deeper into us. If we have a sense of pride in what we do, when we make a mistake, we never want to duplicate the mistake. We want to learn from it immediately and move forward rather than make the same mistake over and over again. So that's why that works on such a powerful level for us. As for me, the one that comes to mind is great fun for me because I never really replicated it, but it really helped me keep an open mind, which was I was doing a project, one of these projects where all the drums had to be done in pretty short order, a day, I think it was 2 days for the project. And I had set up some compression on the toms on the drums that had been very suitable for everything that came before it. And it was totally unsuitable for a particular song. But because we were plowing through so much, it became the signature sound of that song. The fact that it was not wrong, but so distinctive because the compression was so badly set that it became the sound and it became something that everybody really loved because it was so, and that was like, oh wow, you know, it can be that. It can be something where, oh, the book says don't do it this way. The knob twiddler says don't do this this way. Don't set it this way. And yet it can end up being the thing that makes it stand out. And there's another, an almost identical situation, except it involved an entire drum kit on a session that was not supposed to have any drums. I had been recording a wonderful, wonderful vocalist named Christine Lavin on a generally folky record. She's generally an incredibly talented folk musician. And it wasn't supposed to involve drums, but there was a studio kid in the corner and she was doing a vocal. And then she comes into the control room after we've got her vocal and she says, you know, now I really want the drums to come in just for like two measures at the end of this song. And so the producer turns to me and says, you know, so how long will it take you to set up the drum kit? I said, I'm going to use the mics that are already out there. I'm going to use the vocal mics, and we'll make the sound work for that. And so we got this sound that, because it was a song about baseball and because she was singing about being in stadiums, and the compression was set for vocals in a room far away from the drum kit, it ended up sounding very much like it could have been the slapback in a stadium, but not actual slapback. It was more that the compression made it pump in a certain way. And I immediately knew this was perfect. And Christine was, she was right there with me. The producer was pretty good, but I had been filling in for another engineer, and he heard it and he was like, what the hell is this? This isn't, I said, no, you don't understand. The drums are only coming in for two measures. About being you know, in baseball field, this means that for those two measures, this thing's going to just fly out of the speakers. Nobody's going to know what the hell's going on. And so he was resistant, but the producer said, no, I like it. And luckily Christine said she liked it. And so it made it to the record, and soon afterwards, he came to me and said, you were absolutely right. This thing, a normal drum sound would have been just big deal. This made it, like, crazy. And to this day, because it's readily available on YouTube, to this day, I can go to this track, and I can point out to people how something so wrong can be so right. So those are two things that come to mind immediately. Since I make at least a couple of mistakes every day, I'm sure there's plenty of others that I could refer to, but those come to mind right away.
I love those examples because it also speaks to experimentation, which I think is a common thread from the, you know, early days of school right up to what we're talking about now. This is awesome, Mark. I really appreciate this interview. You got a great story. I certainly learned a lot from talking to you, and I'm sure everyone else will as well. I really appreciate this.
Excellent. So everybody stay healthy. If you're going to protest all these terrible killings, I think that try to do it peacefully. I think that Gandhi was right, and violence and looting never is. And it's been a pleasure. It's been a great deal of fun to chat about something that we're both so passionate about.
I really appreciate you chatting.
The Pro Fools podcast is brought to you by The Residence Studios. The Residence Studios is a destination studio located in central Long Island, 1 hour from Manhattan, 1 hour to the Hamptons. We offer a state-of-the-art recording and mixing studio, photo and video facilities with hotel-like amenities, 5 minutes from the beach and minutes away from Long Island's major attractions. Contact us at theresidencestudios@gmail.com or Instagram at theresidencestudios. I hope you've enjoyed the Pro Fools podcast as much as we've enjoyed bringing it to you. There's no one right answer on how to make a great recording. To make great recordings, you must do your best and work your hardest. Don't be afraid to make mistakes, but be sure to quickly get over them and, most importantly, learn from them. Because a wise man knows what a fool he's been. Make sure to like, subscribe, and turn on the bell so you can be notified when we post on YouTube. Follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. You can donate via PayPal at theprofoolspodcast@gmail.com and at theprofoolspodcast@patreon. Email us, questions and otherwise, at theprofoolspodcast@gmail.com. Check out our website, theprofoolspodcast.com.